Chapter 15. The Killing. Hunched in the plane at 35,000 feet, I looked out the window at the rolling clouds below and wondered what we were getting into. The aircraft hummed as we sped toward Vernal. There were three of us, the veterinarian, the physicist, and myself. We had all the equipment we needed, including all the knives and scalpels necessary to further dismember the animal during a necropsy. Just 5 hours after Tom's frantic phone call, we were standing over the animal. The late afternoon breeze blew gently, but an early spring sun was still warm on my face. We were looking at a scene of horror. I felt a churning in my stomach as I looked at the creature. This was something truly bizarre. My immediate impression was that an enormous force had ripped the animal apart. One of the leg bones was lying 10 feet away, having been yanked free of the knee joint. Even with a young calf, the brute force necessary to rip a femur off a knee joint and snap a tendon suggested something very powerful. Yet there was a fastidious delicacy to the way the mutilated calf had been carefully laid out on the grass with all four legs spread neatly away from the body. I had a momentary image of a huge amorphous creature carefully laying a limp rag doll on the grass and gently placing each of the lifeless limbs away from the torso, arranged with the finesse and attention to detail of a Japanese tea ceremony. I shuddered and banished the image from my mind. The combination of overwhelming force in ripping the calf apart and dainty precision in laying the body on the grass seemed all wrong. It disturbed me. There was no smell. The inside of the animal looked pink and tender, very healthy and very clean, almost unnaturally clean. All of the internal organs were gone, and the broken ribs jutted forlornly toward the sky. The head lay sideways, its lifeless eyes staring toward the western sun now low in the sky. We estimated that this was an 84-pound calf, at least 40 pounds of which were gone, if you counted its 3 liters of blood. And this was the most chilling part of the scene. The complete lack of blood. It was as if a giant vacuum cleaner had gone through, in and around the calf's carcass, and sucked up every drop of its blood. We looked for even a speck of blood on the grass or on the animal's hide. Nothing. Not a drop. We looked at each other in stunned silence. We ignored the temptation to scan the snow-covered perimeter of the pasture for something unworldly that still lurked out there, and instead, with a tightness in our guts, went to work. We videotaped the crime scene and scanned the animal and the surrounding ground for magnetic and electric traces, for radio, microwave residue, and, for the hell of it, for nuclear radiation. No one knew who or what did this to the calf, so we thought we might as well check for everything. I gently drew Tom aside. His normally ruddy face was the color of chalk. "Take me through it, step by step," I said. He tried cracking jokes about maybe a coyote with a scalpel had done it, but I could tell his heart was not into making jokes. He walked me to where he had tagged the calf, just a few feet away, then walked me the couple of hundred yards to the west when about 40 minutes later their snarling dog had given them the first hint that something was wrong. "No noise," Tom said to himself, shaking his head in bewilderment. The blue healer had still not shown up, and it was now 6 hours later. "He just took off that way," Tom said, pointing west. "It's just not like him." He rubbed his eyes wearily. No more than 40 minutes had passed in daylight, during which someone or something had entered the field, ripped the young calf away from its mother. She looked like she was still limping. Drained it of blood, meat, and guts, and then carefully placed it on the grass. It just did not seem possible. I looked at the calf's mother. She was standing 100 feet away, her head down near the ground in a peculiar stance that exuded both aggression and fear. She was still breathing in a labored way. She never came closer as the veterinarian quickly stripped her calf's hide. An abrupt, muttered exclamation caught my attention. "Look at the sharp cut," the vet exclaimed. "The ear was cut off with a knife or a scalpel." He was right. Tom nodded and said, "That ear had a big yellow plastic tag." Looking closely, I saw the perfect incision where the cartilage and skin had been sliced. The whole ear had been cleanly removed to the skull. It was a beautiful, almost artistic job. Even without lab pathology results, we all knew there was no way a predator or scavenger could have pulled this off. The cut was perfect and straight and had sliced cleanly through the tissue. One can easily spot the difference between the characteristic torn or ripped cattle hide of a predator or scavenger attack and the sharp cut of a scalpel or a knife when you look under a microscope. And here, even to the naked eye, this was obviously the work of a sharp instrument. The vet took samples just to make sure. We watched, silently, as the vet finished the necropsy. He put the last bits of hide into labeled Ziploc bags for lab analysis. We carefully placed the torn femur into a plastic bag for forensic analysis. I looked around at the beautiful scenery and marveled that such an act of extreme violence could have taken place a few short hours ago in these pristine surroundings. Visibility through the trees and bushes on the perimeter of the large field was good, as the spring growth had not yet begun. Tom had told me this was only the second day of the thaw after winter. I scanned the entire perimeter over 100 yards away. Nothing moved. To the north lay a ridge of reddish clay, probably weathered sandstone. The western perimeter of the pasture of the field was maybe 300 yards away. Before the light dimmed, we organized into groups and quartered the grass, looking for any footprints or vehicle tracks. The hard ground crunched underneath as we walked. The herd of all black cattle kept their distance. They, too, were obviously disturbed. We agreed that the hard-packed grass could maybe have hidden some footprints, but definitely not vehicle tracks. Tom watched us in bemused silence. He seemed relieved to have some company. Occasionally, we glanced nervously toward the perimeter to see if there was anything that shouldn't be there. We stopped our search as darkness fell. As we returned to the science observation trailer less than 100 yards from where the animal had been torn apart, we passed the 3 dog kennels. I could see all 3 animals huddled inside. One whimpered softly. "They haven't come out all day, even for food or water," Tom muttered. This was unusual behavior for 3 aggressive dogs that were used to roaming the land and fending off the coyotes and wild dogs that routinely passed through. And his other blue heeler still had not returned, now more than 12 hours later. In fact, Gorman would never see the animal again. We spent the following day tracking the entire pasture, looking for any evidence, especially the big bright yellow tag from the calf's ear. We had summoned a professional tracker who was due to arrive from Montana in a couple of days. On the evening of March 12th, we gathered in the observation trailer again to discuss the incident. The dogs had finally come out of their kennels, but they were keeping close to us and the trailer. Even to my untrained eye, they had a hunted look. They were plainly still traumatized by whatever had passed through. "Cattle are even more jumpy than yesterday," Tom observed. He was worried. The behavior of the dogs and the cattle suggested that something was lurking nearby. Tom talked repeatedly about the possibility of a predator on the loose. He simply couldn't fathom how somebody with equipment, including sharp instruments, could have pulled off this killing, with both him and his wife only a few 100 yards away. All of us knew from experience that Tom had uncannily sharp eyes and a keen sense of hearing. Then, shortly after 11 p.m., all dogs suddenly started howling and barking hysterically. Tom, the physicist, and I leaped to our feet and ran out the door and into the cold, clear night. We headed for Tom's old beat-up truck. On the driver's side, Tom had affixed a powerful spotlight that was easily maneuverable. He normally drove through his cattle at night during calving season, lighting up the animals as he drove. The powerful spot was excellent for seeing from a distance whether a cow or a calf was in trouble. The truck engine roared as we bounced over the ruts. There were cattle here and there. Some were milling nervously in the distance. Some appeared oblivious. The animals seemed to be bunched toward the northern part of the giant pasture. On one of the turns, the headlight swept over a large black shadow standing in the southeastern tree line of the field. It was only a fleeting glimpse of what looked like a large cow standing in the shadow beneath a large tree at the edge of the field, but far away from the rest of the herd. "Must be in trouble," Tom grunted as he swung the truck away from the main herd and headed south. The perimeter was about 80 yards away when the bouncing headlights suddenly picked up 2 large orbs of yellow light staring fixedly from the same large tree. Did you see that? Two of us said in unison. Tom gunned the engine, and as the headlights danced crazily in front of us, we could now clearly see that the reflected yellow light came from the eyes of a huge animal, probably 20 feet off the ground, perched in the tree. I'm not going to let him get another calf, Tom snarled as he suddenly ground the truck to a halt and reached behind for his rifle. We were no more than 50 yards from the large creature that lay motionless, almost casually, in the tree. The only indication of the beast's presence was the penetrating yellow light of the unblinking eyes as they stared fixedly back into the light. This is unusual behavior, I thought, as Tom steadied the rifle on the open door of the truck. Shouldn't it be running away? The rifle's sharp report rang out, and instantly, like a light being snapped off, the eyes disappeared. Got him, yelled Tom triumphantly. I saw him fall to the ground. We scrambled back into the truck, and Tom stopped about 40 feet from the tree. There was no sign of the large creature under or near the tree. We split up and searched for any sight or sound of the wounded or dead beast. 30 yards to my left, Gorman suddenly yelled, I see him! The shot was quickly followed by two loud reports from his rifle. Got him at point blank, Gorman yelled as we jumped excitedly over the fence into the thick undergrowth. The snow crunched loudly underfoot as we stumbled around looking for some sign of it. We were cautious because a large wounded animal was especially dangerous at night. I was still carrying my video camera as we warily looked all around, half expecting something to spring at us from the darkness. But there was utter silence. He jumped back here when I hit him, Tom said as he scratched his head in puzzlement. I was no more than 40 feet away. Where'd he go? That sucker must have weighed 400 pounds. We began quartering the area, looking at the snow for tracks. Something that big should have left an obvious trail in the snow, and there should have been blood. It was then that I saw it. A single, obvious oval track, about 6 inches in diameter, embedded deeply in the patch of snow. I yelled at the other two, who came running. I shone the flashlight, and there it was. It looked unusual. A single large print in the snow with two sharp claws protruding from the rear of the mark going a couple of inches deeper. It almost looked like a bird of prey, maybe a raptor print, but huge, and from the depth of the print from a very heavy creature. I began videotaping as the physicist unsteadily held the flashlight while looking over his shoulder, waiting for a wounded animal to charge us. Minutes ticked by as we searched in vain for a companion print. We found another one in an area of unmelted snow about 20 feet from the first, but nothing else. We listened carefully for any movement in the undergrowth as we searched. There was an eerie silence in the area, broken only by the distant bellowing of the cows over on the other side of the pasture. They were still deeply disturbed by the commotion we had generated and were not coming over to investigate. Almost 2 hours later, we gave up, exhausted, cold, and still slightly jangled from the brief burst of adrenaline. Again, there was an unspoken shudder at the idea of sleeping in the trailer, a mere 100 yards from where the bizarre creature, or creatures, had apparently vanished into thin air, having been shot with a high-powered rifle. It was time to call an end to another busy day on the Skinwalker Ranch. The next day, we compared notes and debriefed Tom on what had happened. He swore that there had been two large animals, one in the tree, and the other on the ground. He also swore that he had hit both animals, the first with a single bullet, the second with two bullets. Tom was an expert marksman, able to kill a coyote at 500 yards, and he had shot both of these large animals at close range. He described the second animal that crouched in the undergrowth as huge, heavily muscled, and looking like a 400-pound wild dog. The animal had been staring at him and had tensed just before springing when Tom had shot it twice from no more than 40 feet, yet no signs of blood and two confusing distant single tracks in the snow added to, rather than solved, the mystery. The incidents of March 10th through 12th, 1997, were very difficult to explain. They were certainly verification of unusual or anomalous activity, but did they fit the criteria that NIDS was looking for? Those criteria initially had been defined as the verification of events first described by Gorman, the witnessing of unidentified flying objects by the scientists, and their capture on camera or video images. the bizarre killing of the calf, and the potentially deadly nighttime encounter with phantom creatures that were shot but left no blood and few tracks did not appear to fulfill the criteria of anything that could be reported at a scientific meeting. Nor could this kind of incident be written up for a peer-reviewed science journal. In fact, beyond the videotaped track in the snow, there was no physical evidence that this incident had ever happened. And at a subsequent science advisory board meeting, the board made it abundantly clear that these events, in the absence of physical evidence, did not constitute verification of anything. Little did we know that these unexpected events would become part of an increasingly frustrating pattern of transient, difficult to interpret, but frightening events and phenomena that would never again be repeated in our presence.